Welcome to Bible Study 1965. I would like to remind you about the other sessions. They will be as follows. October 20th, Common and Uncommon Sense Proverbs, Chairman Mrs. Robert Kearns. October 27th, Job, Satan, and God. Job will be the topic, and the chairman will be Mrs. Ben Barron. November 3rd, The End That Never Came, Daniel, and the chairman will be Mrs. Roger Burkill. Our ticket chairmen are Mrs. Eric Brook, Mrs. Michael Eckstein, and Mrs. Gerald Radnick. For those of you who do not have Bibles and wish to purchase them, they are for sale at the table in the rear. We also have Rabbi Daniel's new book for sale at $7.50. And now, I am sure you are all looking forward to hearing Rabbi Daniel Silver conduct our first session on Sing Unto the Lord, Psalms. Rabbi Silver.
Well, welcome to Bible 1965A. Last year, we delved a little bit into the history and the beginnings, the background. And this year I'm reversing myself. I'm dealing with the last books of the Bible. I'm dealing with complete books of the Bible. Psalms, Proverbs, Job, and Daniel. No public relations intended. The Bible is, in our tradition, divided into three sections. I know that some of you can't see it, but I wrote them on the board earlier. The Torah, which we usually think of as the whole Bible or the scroll in our ark, but which is actually only the first five books, the five books of Moses, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. A section known as Nevi'im, which is the Hebrew word for prophets, which include the designated prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on, and also the historical books which retell the background in the days in which the prophets taught and wrote, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And then a conglomerate book or section known as the Ketubim, the writings, the holy writings, which includes the poetry, the proverb, the wisdom literature, Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, and a review book of history, Chronicles. All the books which we're going to touch are from the third of these sections, the Ketubim. This is a broad, amorphous definition. Each book is itself, almost each book is an anthology or a library, and they're fascinating. They're also the books of the Bible which can be read by you with the least amount of historical information required. They read pretty well straight off, and they read without any necessity to place them in their time or their place. Now, the book of Psalms is both the most popular section of the Bible and the most difficult to lecture on. Most of the Psalms stand on their own feet. And by that I mean it matters little if you know when they were written, whether in one century or another, whether they were written by a Judean, a man from the south, or by an Israelite, a man from the north, whether they were written under the monarchy or in the exile or after the return from the Babylonian captivity. Certain Psalms express moods, ordinary human emotions. And these moods and these emotions are innocent, direct, and they speak to us across the ages. Typically, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou far from my help at the words of my cry? O my God, I call by day, but thou answerest not, and at night, and there is no surcease for me, yet thou art holy. I chose this paragraph because this morning I walked into the temple, and there seated before the Ark, before our sukkah, was a lonely woman. She was quiet, introspective, looking neither at the ark nor at the temple. She was worried, and I suspect beyond worry, and I suspect somehow she found strength and faith in the presence of God. And I suspect she could have written these lines. Other poems in the Book of Psalms express other pieties and other feelings, the familiar categories of hope and of confidence. Weeping may tarry for the night, but with the morning there is joy. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable unto thee, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. And still other sections of the psalm simply set down in unforgettable poetic form the basic truths of human life. We bring our years to an end as a tale that is told. The days of our years are 80 years, or even by reason of strength some 80 years. Yet is their pride but travail and vanity, for it is speedily gone, and we fly away. So teach us, O Lord, to number our days, that we may get us a heart of wisdom. Time is our one possession, and the use of time our one discretion. I was asked just 2 days ago if Jews in biblical days actually lived the 80 years and the 80 years. We've heard so much about the miracles of medicine and about the lengthening of the lifespan, and it's true. But the lifespan has been lengthened from the ill health and the diseases and the plagues of the Middle Ages. In the rather clean air, in the open country, in the desert around Israel, men lived as we live today, from 70 to 80 years. This was a normal span of life. It was only when men insisted in cooping themselves up into Roman cities, and living in their own filth and their stench and their illness and in their contagion, that human life became short and as brief as it was, as it is still today in a country like India. The Psalms require then neither archaeology nor really a knowledge, an intricate knowledge of history to be appreciated. What they require is a sensitivity to language. You've got to love the spoken and the written word. You have to love symbol and metaphor, a language which can mean one thing on the surface, but shimmering off of that surface, there are all new kinds of colors and shapes and hues and meanings. And finally, you have to have a sharp sense of your own mortality and your own frailty. By and large, adolescents find the psalm sticky and square. It's not that they don't appreciate the language or the honesty of emotion in most of the psalms. It's rather the simple fact that they've never been to a funeral, that they have no sense that they are not like unto the gods, immortal. And really, they've had no need to pray. All you have to do is to turn to mother and say, please, and that's enough. They don't know what it means when the psalmist says that he walks in the valley of the shadow of death. They don't know what it means to be frightened by the arrow that flieth by the day, and by the pestilence that walketh at the noonday, and by the destruction that wasteth in the darkness. The first human emotion, the first emotion to which we respond, is the emotion of love. And the first book, I think, which young people, especially adolescents, respond to is the Song of Songs, which is simply a collection of the wedding poetry, the love poetry of our people. And since it's a beautiful fall day and I don't want to be morbid, let's begin with a little bit of the poetry. We're talking of poetry of the Bible, the kind of poetry you won't find in the Psalms, but typical of Hebrew poesy, a verse or verses from the Song of Songs. Let me read it to you. Don't follow it, don't look at it, just enjoy it. The worst thing to do with the Psalms, by the way, is to get too stickly with the language. You have to feel it, just enjoy, listen. I am a rose of Sharon, a lily of the valleys. As a lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. As an apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. Under its shadow I delight to sit, and its fruit was sweet to my taste. He hath brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me is love. Stay ye me with dainties, refresh me with apples, for I am lovesick. Let his left hand be under my head, and his right hand embrace me. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles and by the hinds of the field, that ye awaken not, nor stir up love, until it please. Hark, my beloved, behold, he cometh leaping over the mountains, skipping upon the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young hart. Behold, he standeth behind our wall. He looketh in through the windows, he peereth through the lattice. My beloved spoke and said unto me, rise up, my loved one, my fair one, and come away. For lo, the winter is past, and the rain is over and gone. And the flowers appear on the earth, and the time of singing is come. And the voice of the dove is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines in blossom give forth their fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Well, to any young man who has dreamed of serenading his loved one with the Watusi and with some beat music, the loved one, the fair one, she who is to come away with him, convinces him that the Bible isn't quite for dried up and desiccated people only. But we've outgrown that. We know that there are other ranges of human emotion which need to be expressed, other poetry which the heart instinctively feels. And it is this other poetry which is expressed in the Book of Psalms. The poetry of divine love, the poetry of human decency, the poetry of the loneliness of age, the poesy of the anguish of faith and of the fear of death, and our uncertainty at facing the future. And you must be prepared, able to have sensed these moods, if the Psalms are to touch you in the deepest places of your soul. Now, touching any poetry, the most that any instructor can do is to place the material in its context, tell you what we know about the applicable terms of the art, suggest the reach of the symbols, and let the literature speak for itself. If you have no love of the bizarre and the mysterious, the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner remains a strange and rather awkward tale. If you have no empathy with the despair and the loneliness and the outreaching and the prayer and the hope and the search of life, perhaps the Psalms will fail to touch you, although they have a magic, and they weave their magic. And their magic has a way of reaching out and drawing us in into its terms. Now, there are 150 psalms in our present collection. But not all of the psalms, not all of the hymns of the Bible are to be found in this one book. We're told in the Bible the story of Hannah. Hannah was a fine woman, but a childless woman. And she prayed to God for a child, and she promised God that if a child were granted her, she would dedicate that child to the temple. He would be in the ministry of the Lord. And a child was born, a child who was in turn to become Samuel, next to Moses, the next great leader of our people. And the Bible tells us that once Hannah had received the child, she came to the sanctuary, and she offered up there a hymn of praise to God. I'd like to read that hymn with you. It is a psalm. Hannah did not write this psalm. She simply remembered one of the wonderful, pious melodies of her people, which to a degree reflected what she was feeling, or someone else put this psalm in her mouth. But it's very typical of this poetry and a good place to begin. Turn to the first book of Samuel, if you will. I hope you all remember how to find things in the Bible. And turn to chapter 2. You all got it? If it helps, and this is not the way I should give you directions, if you have a Jewish Publication Society Bible, you'll probably find it on page 362. But that's the coward's way out. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel. And chapter 2. And Hannah prayed and said, My heart exulteth in the Lord. My horn is exalted in the Lord. My mouth is enlarged over mine enemies because I rejoice in thy salvation. There is none holy as the Lord, for there is none besides thee. Neither is there any rock like our God. Multiply not exceeding proud talk, nor let arrogance come out from your mouth. For the Lord is a God of knowledge, and by him actions are weighed. The bows of the mighty men are broken, and they that stumbled are girded with strength. They that were full have hired out themselves for bread, and they that were hungry have ceased. While the barren hath borne 7, she that had many children hath languished. The Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. The Lord maketh poor and maketh rich. He bringeth low. He also lifteth up. He raiseth up the poor out of the dust. He lifteth up the needy from the dunghill to make them sit with princes and inherit the throne of glory. For the pillars of the earth are the Lord's, and he hath set the world upon them. Now this psalm is obviously the psalm of a poor man, or a humble man, or a man against whom the wheel of life has turned, who has had bad fortune, who looks about him and sees people he does not like, the wicked, flourishing, and he praises God because he says that he has faith that God will somehow right the balance. He killeth, he maketh alive, the barren woman bears, and she with many children languishes. The full have to hire themselves out for bread, have to become slaves. The hungry cease. Now, it's simply the allusion to the barren woman who has 7 children, which probably led the author to put this prayer in the mouth of Hannah. But what we have here is an emotion. It does not hold water if you examine it critically. There is no such balance in life between wickedness and punishment, goodness and reward. This is a problem, by the way, that the book of Psalms deals with constantly. You find exaggerated feeling in the book of Psalms, and you'll find this line. I was a young man, and now I have grown old, and I have never seen a good man who has been forsaken. Well, it's not true. It's on the face of it, not true. But these men were talking themselves into faith. They were working themselves into an experience, an understanding, a confidence in God. And this, the most troubling of all problems, why do the righteous suffer, was their stumbling block. And they tried to overcome it, in a sense, by brainwashing themselves that this was not, in fact, so. There is a cadence to this language. My heart exulteth in the Lord. My horn is exalted. My horn is exalted in the Lord. And this is the enthusiasm and the thrust, the vigor of the faith. Many of the Psalms then can be criticized if we examine them critically, but they must be understood as the expression of human beings, of a Hannah, of a person who suddenly and wondrously has seen life come right. Here, after many childless years, she suddenly had a child. And how often in our human experience there's a sudden reversal of fortune, and the intensity of emotion breaks out from us, and we exaggerate what we feel, for good or for hurt. And the psalm is, in a sense, that exaggeration, that statement of the heart. Now, I started with this psalm because it proves that not all of the psalms, all of the hymns, or all of the poetry of the of biblical days was included in the final editing of the book of Psalms. As a matter of fact, we have found in the last few years a number of psalms in the material, in the parchment, which has come to us from the Dead Sea Scroll people, which are not at all in our Bible, which were unknown until they were rediscovered. In other words, there was a treasury, many such poems which circulated in biblical days, and an anthology. A collection of these was made and finally agreed upon and canonized. You'll find, as you leaf through the Bible in strange places, psalms. Jonah recites a psalm in the middle of the whale when he's been cast overboard and the whale swallows him up. All of a sudden, he breaks out into song and he praises God for allowing him, of all things, to sacrifice in the temple of Jerusalem. The psalm has no relevance to the story, except that the imagery of the psalm is that of a man who has been cast into the depths, and out of the depths finds somehow, again, his faith in God. The Hebrew title of this anthology is Tehillim, which means literally songs of praise. Hannah's prayer is a classic example of the genre. Psalms of praise, psalms of laudation. Not all of the poetry is of the type, though, of Hannah's prayer. And our book has long sported another name, the Book of Psalms, or the Psalter. It was so entitled by Egyptian Jews who first translated the Bible into Greek in the second century before the Common Era, about 2,200 years ago. They called it Psalterion, after a harp with which the troubadours of the day accompanied themselves as they sang these hymns. And this is important, because all of this poetry was meant to be sung, and the line of the language is meant to be melodic. It is brief, because the voice can only carry so many notes before it must pause for a breath. It emphasizes the noun and the verb rather than long strings of adjectives and adverbs. It is direct rather than obtuse. It is simple rather than erudite. It is meant to be sung in accompaniment with an instrument or at any number of instruments. And we have in the Book of Psalms, as a matter of fact, indications of a number of these instruments which were used: the harp, the timbrel, the cymbal, bells, trumpets, stringed instruments of all kinds, and others. The Psalter was chosen as its title, the Book of Psalms, because of an ancient tradition found in our Bible which knew King David as an expert in singing and in the playing, and because of an equally ancient tradition found in our Bible that King David was the author of at least 73 of these 150 pieces. If you open the Bible to the Book of Psalms and turn almost any place, turn to Psalms 3, 4, 5. You'll see a superscription, almost like as if we had a book title or program notes. Under Psalm 3, the first line, a Psalm of David, when he fled from Absalom his son. They give us actually an historical identification. 4, for the leader with string music, a psalm of David. 5, for the leader upon the nihilot, some kind of musical instrument, a psalm of David. 6, for the leader with string music and on the sheminit, some other kind of instrument, a psalm of David. So at least in the second century before the Common Era, we have an indication by whoever edited this collection that David was believed to be the author of a majority, close to a majority, of this material. The question which we must ask is whether this ascription can be accepted as fact. Let's analyze the tradition first off. The rather competent historian of the first book of Samuel tells us that Saul, the first king of Israel, not unlike our own Abraham Lincoln, suffered from deep moods of melancholia, from black depression. Lacking psychiatrists, the ancients hired troubadours and musicians to distract them, to exorcise the devils, to calm them. It was almost cheaper, I think. We have an indication of how this came to be in the case of David. If you turn to 1 Samuel chapter 16, beginning in verse 14, We have a rather simple story told us. Now the spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrified him. And Saul's servant said unto him, Behold now, an evil spirit from God terrifieth thee. Let our Lord now command thy servants that are before thee to seek out a man who is a skillful player on the harp. And it shall be, when the evil spirit from God cometh upon thee, that he shall play with his hand, and thou shalt be well. And Saul said unto his servants, Provide me now a man that can play well, and bring him to me. Then answered one of the young men and said, Behold, I have seen a son of Jesse the Bethlehemite that is skillful in playing, and a mighty man of valor, and a man of war, and prudent in affairs, and a comely person. And the Lord is with him. Wherefore Saul sent messengers unto Jesse and said, Send me David thy son, who is with the sheep. And Jesse took an ass laden with bread and a bottle of wine and a kid and sent them by David, his son, to Saul. And David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. And Saul sent to Jesse, saying, Let David, I pray thee, stand before me, for he hath found favor in my sight. And it came to pass, when the evil spirit from God was upon Saul, that David took the harp and played with his hand. So Saul found relief, and it was well with him, and the evil spirit departed from him. In other words, David was the victrola and the long playing record which soothes our tired minds. And more than that, he was the musical distraction which could soothe the terrifying spirits, the fears and the anguish and the loneliness. David becomes king of Israel, in effect, because his mother told him to practice the piano. We had then an historical tradition, an ancient tradition, that knew David as a skillful musician. When Amos, 200 years after David's death, wanted to castigate and to specify those who were at ease in Zion and therefore to be condemned, he chastised them in these terms. Those that lie upon beds of ivory, mattresses that are too thick. Those that stretch themselves upon their couches and eat the lambs out of the flocks and the calves out of the midst of the stalls. Those that thrum upon the psaltery. Those that devise for themselves instruments of music like David. And this tradition of David as the harpist, of course, has remained with us. You see it in Jewish art. You'll see it in some of the biblical pictures of Marc Chagall. You will see it on the windows of our chapel. If you look on the windows in the chapel, you'll notice a harp, a three or four stringed harp with a crown above it in each of four panels. And this harp with a crown above it is a traditional Jewish symbol. It refers to David and to his authorship of the Psalms. This so much so was David known as the patron of music that when the biblical biographer puts a last speech into his mouth, he concludes in this way. Now these are the last words of David, the saying of David, the son of Jesse, and the saying of the man raised on high, the anointed of the God of Jacob, and the sweet singer of Zion. So David becomes not only the king, not only the great monarch of our people, the founder of the dynasty, but the sweet singer of Zion. And the authorship of these 73 Psalms remained unquestionably David's until two or three generations ago, when for the first time scholars began to question, as they did all traditions, this particular tradition. Some argue from David's character. David is pictured in our Bible as a professional soldier, as a warrior king, as a genius in realpolitik. Danger and violence seem to rub out and to make brittle and vulgar the subtler ranges of human emotion. And many argue that a man of such violence and such anger and such crudeness in his political life could not be the author of such subtle and exalted poetry. And this argument gave rise to a delightful bit of doggerel which expressed these doubts. King Solomon and King David lived very wicked lives with 50 concubines and quite as many wives. But when old age came creeping in, they were filled with qualms. So Solomon wrote the Proverbs, and David wrote the Psalms. Now, whether we argue from wives, or wine, or war, the argument is not conclusive. For whatever college professors may feel about generals, all of them are not hard-nosed tin soldiers. We have the example of Alexander the Great, who was both philosopher and poet and conqueror of the world. We have the example of Marcus Aurelius, who was both philosopher and Caesar of all Rome. we have the rather literate example of some of our own generals and their biographies and the materials that they wrote coming out of the last war. Indeed, this line of reasoning was not the major criticism advanced by the scholars. 20 years ago, it was generally believed that all that was exalted and universal and most noble in the Bible was a rather late arrival in the biblical scene. Biblical critics were applying Darwin's theories of evolution to the world of ideas. It fitted the realities of such science as there was at the time, and it fitted rather neatly the Christian confidence that what is later is better, and therefore the New Testament being later is better than the old. At one point, some scholars dated all of the Psalms in the second century or third centuries before the Common Eras, almost 800 years after the death of King David. The rude early Hebrew, they argued, could not have had such exalted thoughts. He could not have mastered the intricacies of the poetic discipline. However, this argument from evolution has been shattered, and rather completely so, in the last 20 years by fact. And the facts come largely from archaeology. Archaeologists began to uncover at a place called Ras Shamra, which is in Syria, a library of materials written in the 15th and 16th pre-Christian centuries, which showed a competence in language, a control of the forms of poetry, which is equal to that in our Psalms. In other words, 700 years before David, it was possible for the people in this area to use Hebrew meter to express noble thought, and there was no reason to believe that these tools, these language tools, were unavailable to David in his time. There was also the argument that some of the language in the Psalms is late. Some of it reflects what we call Aramaisms, the Aramaic tongue which became the prevalent tongue of the Jews in the second and first centuries before the Common Era, which was a tongue spoken by Jesus and his disciples. But we have now found that Aramaic was spoken by Jews way back in the 6th and 7th and even in the 8th centuries before the Common Era. And this argument, too, has gone by the board. We also now know that the sectarians who lived at the Dead Sea knew of these Psalms and knew them to be ancient, which means that in the 2nd century before the Common Era, the Psalms were already known as venerable and old. And finally, the whole attitude of criticism, which sees monotheism and universalism entering Judaism only with the exile, with Jeremiah and Ezekiel, has been shattered, as we have seen more and more that Moses and Samuel came to almost the same ideas. Now, does this mean that David was actually the author of these Psalms? Probably not. It means that they were written, or could have been written, in the time of David. It means that David could have written some of them. But it also means that ancient poets, knowing that papyrus and parchment was scarce, knowing that their poetry was not likely to pass muster and be remembered through the generations in various editions, unless they could add to it the name of a royal author, in all probability ascribed to their poetry the authorship of the king who was the sweet singer of Zion. So briefly put, we cannot tell whether David authored any or all or some of these Psalms. He could have authored some. They come from his period of history, at least many of them. But we can only say that David was known in ancient times as the royal patron of the hymn, of the psalm, and let it go at that. Can any of the Psalms be dated? Will this help us in our search for understanding? Very few. The language of the Psalms is the literate language of biblical days, a language which was spoken from the days of the judges down to the days of the end of the Bible. Only a few Psalms give us, from their inner context, an indication of when they were written. Let me cite one or two for you and see if you've become good historians over the past year. Return to Psalm 126. When the Lord brought back those that returned to Zion, we were like unto them that dream. Then was our mouth filled with laughter and our tongue with singing. Then said they among the nations, the Lord hath done great things with these, the Lord hath done great things with us. We are rejoiced. Turn our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the dry land. They that sow in tears shall reap in joy. Though he goeth on his way weeping, that beareth a measure of seed, he shall come home with joy, bearing his sheaves. When you think of a moment in biblical history which this would fit, Ruth, it almost sounds like Ruth, but the captivity, when the Lord brought back those that returned to Zion, the first line. The great exile of our people took place in the year 586. The Babylonians came down, they burnt the temple, they razed Jerusalem. All of the middle class and the noble class was taken into exile. It was as if Israel had never been. And then in the year 516, Cyrus, king of Persia, Persia had in the meantime conquered Babylonia, allowed the Jews to begin to come back and to rebuild. And this psalm obviously comes from this period of return and rebuilding. It begins in a sense of exaltation that that moment is now at hand. Then was our mouth filled with laughter and our tongue was singing. So here we have an indication of a psalm which is late rather than early. And it gives us a good indication of the composite nature of this book. One more, Psalm 137. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, we wept, when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst thereof, we hung up our harps. For here they that led us captive asked of us words of song, and our tormentors asked of us mirth. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget her cunning. Let my mouth cleave to the roof, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I remember thee not, if I set not Jerusalem above my chiefest joy. Well, this psalm was obviously written in Babylon, obviously written in the exile, obviously brought back by the people from the exile as a song which had somehow kept them going, kept them alive, kept up their confidence. Let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth if I remember thee not, if I set not Jerusalem above my chiefest joy. And those of you who know the traditional Haggadah, Passover Haggadah, know that through the long centuries of pogrom and dispersion and exile, the Jews in medieval Europe recited this psalm as part of the Haggadah story. This brought it up to date. They were again in exile. They were again being mocked and scorned. If I forget thee not, O Jerusalem, again the hope of Zion burnt within them. But having said that, we've about dated the psalms that can be easily dated. And the rest are left as a fine collection of poetry which must be read and understood by itself. Now there's one other inner division within the book of Psalms. This book of Psalms is divided into five parts. Each of these parts ends with what we call a doxology, a brief few line mention of the many attributes in the greatness of God. The division into five sections is probably late and artificial. Only the first three sections seem to have a continuity and seem to have a shape to them. Probably the final editing of the book of Psalms attempted to duplicate the editing of the Torah. As there were five books in the Torah, so there would be five books in this cherished liturgy, in the worship book of our people. But we know that many selections of Psalms, many parchments with Psalms in odd form and not in their present number existed. We found some among the Dead Sea peoples. And all we can say is this, that the book of Psalms is an anthology of anthologies. You'll find, for instance, in the book of Psalms, we just read one, 14 Psalms which are listed as songs of ascent. These were songs which we know from the Mishnah to have been sung by the pilgrims as on Sukkot time. And at Passover time, they brought the harvest with them from their farms and their communities to Jerusalem. Jerusalem is up in the hills, and these were the songs of ascent that they sang along the road, much as our Boy Scouts sing as they tramp along happily on their hikes. But in this case, it's not the pack and the den and the group spirit which is involved. It's their coming to God to offer him gratefully thanksgiving for the harvest. There are a group of songs which are called the Hallel songs. Hallel means hallelujah, praise. We recite these songs also on the great pilgrimage festivals. Praise, O ye servants of the Lord, praise be the name of the Lord, Praise be the name of the Lord from this time forth and forever. Hallelujah. There are a group of psalms which are ascribed to a group of priests known as the Korahites. We know nothing more about them except this name. And that they seem to be liturgic psalms, and by that I mean they seem to have been composed and written directly for the sacrifice and the ritual of the temple. And in some of these psalms we can almost sense the way in which they were used in the ancient temple. More of that in a minute. What we have then is a collection, an anthology of anthologies, and to add to the confusion, it's patent that some of the psalms are themselves a composite of a number of psalms. At this point, you get into scholarship, and we stop. You'll find in the psalms great beauty and some rather prosaic language. You'll find some fine philosophy and some very mundane thinking. You'll find theology which is innocent, naive, and theology which is erudite and academic. In other words, you'll find a reflection of almost every kind of human being and every attitude towards faith. Now, before we move on, we need to say a word or two about Hebrew poetry. What are its laws? What are its rules? How is it put together? What should we look for? What makes it poetry? It's simply not, as in much of modern English poetry, the fact that it's printed in short lines down the page rather than across as prose. Well, there are a number of tenets and canons of Hebrew poetry, and I'd like very quickly and as simply as I can to explain them to you. If you turn to Psalm 145, you'll notice down the left-hand column, the Hebrew alphabet. Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, He, Vav. This kind of psalm is called an acrostic. By acrostic, we mean that every line of the psalm began with a subsequent letter of the alphabet. In medieval Hebrew poetry, the author often hid his name in this way. He would write out his name down the page and then write lines across the page, and if you read the first letter of each line, you'll know his name. In other words, his authorship could never be separated from the psalm itself. The cruder form of this is Psalm 145, which takes the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet and gives you a praise of God based on each letter. Some psalms have a partial alphabet, some psalms repeat the alphabet a number of times. This kind of psalm is usually the most prosaic and banal in the book of Psalms. It's an artificial form, artificial on the surface of it, and it restricted the ability of the man to express himself. And it's obvious that he wrote this as a literary enterprise rather than in the heat of feeling and in the innocence of emotion. But in any case, we find a number of these in the Bible. Then, if you will turn to Psalm 114, I think I can explain to you very quickly the basis of Hebrew poetry. When we think of poetry, we think of rhyme and we think of meter. You have to take both these terms and put them aside for a moment in this description of Hebrew poetry. The Jews did not use rhyme because rhyme was too simple for them. Hebrew is a language which uses roots and adds the endings, both on nouns and on verbs, on adjectives and adverbs, to these roots. So it's very easy to take any idea and make it rhyme. You can rhyme endlessly in Hebrew. There's no trick to it. So they avoided rhyme, except when it was inevitable. The meter, we simply cannot express because we don't know the stress of Hebrew as it was spoken in those days. Instead of which, we do know this about Hebrew poetry. In the first place, the basis of poetry was what they called parallelism. Two ideas or two lines which were intimately related to them. Notice, when Israel came forth out of Egypt, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language, same thought, a variant. Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. Same idea, different words. The sea saw it and fled, the Jordan turned backwards. Same. The mountains skipped like rams, the hills like young sheep. What aileth thee, O thou sea, that thou fleest, thou Jordan, that thou turnest backward? Again, the same. Ye mountains that ye skip like rams, ye hills like young sheep. Tremble thou earth at the presence of the Lord, at the presence of the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of waters. So the first principle is what we call parallelism. And the lines either complement one another or provide an exact parallel to each other or are antithetical to each other. Weeping may tarry for the night, but with the morning there is joy. Or they may be climactic, building up to a climax. The law of the Lord is perfect, restoring the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, enduring forever. Behold, a good doctrine has been given unto you. Forsake it not. We don't know why parallelism was so important. It may have been that it was easier to memorize. One idea suggested its mate. It may have been a way to bring out the full nuance and the subtlety of the thought. But in any case, parallelism is the basic building block of Hebrew poetry. Now, it's not all so simple as in the psalm. Sometimes it'll be four lines which are contrasted, which are parallel, or it may be whole paragraphs which are parallel. But you'll notice in most of this poetry that parallelism is the dominant motif. And finally, you'll notice that there is a certain rhythm or stress to the language. Let me read you this psalm in Hebrew. I don't expect you to understand every word, but you've read the psalm, and I think you'll get a little bit of the sense of the language. B'tzeit Yisrael mimitzrayim, Beit Yaakov me'am lo'az, hayta Yehuda l'kodesho, Yisrael memshalto. Hayam ra'a v'yanos, hayaden yisov la'achor. הערים רקדו חיילים, גבעות כבני צאן. מלאך הים כי תנוס, הירדן תיסוב לאחור. הערים תרקדו כאלים, גבעות כבני צאן. מלפני אדוני חולי ארץ, מלפני אלוה יעקב. החופכי הצור אגם מים, הלמיש למענו מים. Now you've heard many of these psalms. You understand their structure best, really, when you hear them with an old-time chazan. Because they were written to be sung. And singing brings out the motion which is written into every word, which the spoken voice can never do. Or akdu, for instance, has that sense of trembling, of dancing, of motion. And a good trill in a baritone's voice can bring it out. And it's probably in this way that it was sung a long time ago. Now, the absence of rhyme and of a complicated metrical scheme has this virtue for us, that no one has tried to force the Psalms in translation into an archaic and complicated metrical scheme which destroys the meaning of the beauty of the language. And by and large, the Psalms have been well translated. And because they emphasize so much the building blocks of the nouns and the verbs, they come over to us, and we can understand them as they are. Now, if you would know, if we cannot know when most of the Psalms were written, we do know why they were written, or at least how they were used. And I'd like to read to you very briefly, not from the Bible, but from a second century book, The Wisdom of Ben Sirach, which describes a service by a high priest in the temple in Jerusalem. How glorious he was when the people gathered round him as he came out of the inner sanctuary. When he put on his glorious robe and clothed himself with superb perfection and went up to the holy altar, he made the court of the sanctuary glorious. And when he received the portions from the hands of the priest as he stood by the hearth of the altar with a garland of brethren around him, he was like a young cedar of Lebanon, and they surrounded him like the trunks of palm trees. All the sons of Aaron in their splendor, the Lord's offering in their hands before the whole congregation of Israel. Finishing the service at the altars and arranging the offering to the Most High, he reached out his hand to the cup and poured a libation of the blood of the grape. He poured it out at the foot of the altar, a pleasing odor to the Most High, the King of all. Now, then the sons of Aaron shouted. They sounded the trumpets of hammered work. They made a great noise to be heard for remembrance before the Most High. Then all the people together made haste and fell to the ground upon their faces to worship their Lord. And the singers praised him with their voices in sweet and full-toned melody. And the people besought the Lord Most High in prayer before him who is merciful, till the order of worship of the Lord was ended, so they completed his worship. We had then in the ancient temple professional choirs, much as we have here. But we had also a professional orchestra, which we generally lack here. And these professional choirs were situated in appropriate niches and alcoves of the temple. And all the ritual actions of the priest before the sacrificial altar, and all the actions of the congregation as they brought their offerings and they came to prayer, were accompanied by appropriate music. Now, some of these moments must have been very dramatic. We've just completed Yom Kippur. And we know that at Ne'ilah time, the end of Yom Kippur day, as the people would file out from this magnificent building, from its open courtyards, the choir and the orchestra of the temple would situate themselves on the wall, the outside wall, in the east gate through which everybody left. And as the people would leave, they repeated one by one the musical themes of Yom Kippur. And then as that final shofar was sounded, which we heard, which gives us a thrill, the gates of the temple were just locked shut, Ne'ilah, closed. And that was it. So what we have is a very dramatic and a very beautiful form of worship. And we know very often the exact psalms which were sung on particular occasions. And our prayer book took over these psalms, and we still read them day by day as they were read in the ancient temple. We also know how congregation and choir came together, the origin of our responsive reading. If you turn to Psalm 136, I think I can take you back into biblical days. I'll be the choir, and you be the congregation. And you have to know three words. Ki le'olam chasdo. For his mercy endureth forever. Say it. Ki le'olam chasdo. Ki? Oh, come on. Ki le'olam chasdo. You can do better than that. Ki le'olam chasdo. There were no prayer books in those days. So all that a congregation could be entrusted with were simple responses. And this was one of them. And the choir, the baritone lead, and I'm not going to try to sing it, would give you the guideline to which you would respond, Ki le'olam chasdo. So let's try it. O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good. Ki le'olam chasdo. O give thanks unto the God of gods. O give thanks unto the Lord of lords. To him who alone doeth great wonders. To him that by understanding made the heavens. To him that spread forth the earth above the waters. To him that made great lights. The sun to rule by day. The moon and stars to rule by night. A little schwach. But I hope you get the point. The choir keyed the service, and in this praise of God, which is simply an extended list of his creative wonders, a new thought was thrown out to which the people simply responded like Amen, Ki Leolam Chasdo. In brief, the Book of Psalms is an anthology. It's an anthology of the liturgical poetry of our people. This poetry was used as part of worship in the temple. It is still used as the major part of worship by the Jewish people. If you were to take even our Union Prayer Book, our Reform liturgy, and you were to separate it out sentence by sentence, you'd find that about 60% of the language is directly taken from the Book of Psalms. In the traditional service, the proportion may go even higher. The Book of Psalms, however, was not uniquely written for the liturgy. Many of the materials in the Book of Psalms were written as private expressions of feeling, and then with poetry which was taken over by the service and by the priests for their own purposes. Some of it is as old, perhaps, as the 9th or 10th centuries before the Common Era. Some of it is perhaps as recent as the 2nd or 3rd centuries before the Common Era, when this book was finally dedicated. Each psalm is in its own way a gem. I've given you the skeleton and the structure, and I hope, after a question period, to give you one psalm in its depth and its meaning. So I think what I'll do is to pause now and to let you ask the questions which are on the tip of your pencils, if not the tip of your tongues, and then we'll go on from here. Yes, anybody? Everything is crystal clear? I hope so. Yes, you have a question? Well, very good. Let me go on. Yes.
Why was, in the first quotation that we read from Samuel, why was evil in parentheses?
Because it's the Hebrew word doesn't say it, but it's obviously the meaning of the sentence. His mercy forever. Forever his mercy. I hope you never forget those three words now. I've accomplished something. Now what I want to do with you is to talk about the most familiar psalm of all, the 23rd psalm. And much of what I've said, or almost all and more, I have written up in a little pamphlet, which will be ready, I hope, by our meeting next week. The 23rd psalm is known to all of you, probably known by heart by most of you. It's possibly the best known poem in literature. For those who enjoy a vigorous faith, the psalm's piety fits words to feeling. To anyone who is at all sensitive, these verses express the strengthening which a steady faith permits. The verses are simple and honest. The language is as simple as the appeal is immediate. Indeed, as we say it, it's hard to realize that we are reading lines which were written perhaps 2,500 years ago. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in the green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He guideth me in straight paths for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou hast anointed my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Now, to translate is to do violence. No translation fully matches the original. The familiar rendering of this psalm, which so many of you were saying under your voices with me, has a comfortable grace and is by and large faithful to the Hebrew. Its major fault for us is that it trips too lightly off the tongue. We respond to the cadence, we rarely really think about the meaning. I've tried a new translation, not so much to be an improvement, but to make you think, to make you give you a pause for reflection. Perhaps this unfamiliar idiom will give these lines a new vigor and allow them to be heard. God is my shepherd, I shall not want. He gives me rest in green pasture. He guides me by the restful waters. He refreshes my soul. He directs me along straight trails for his name's sake. Even when I pass through the valley of ominous shadows, I am not frightened, for you are with me. Your club and your staff calm me. You provide for me even when there are enemies about. Your care exceeds all expectation. My cup overflows. Truly, a generous goodness will pursue me all the days of my life, and I shall be with God as long as I live. Now, the psalm, however we translate it, breathes the pastoral air. We associate it with open spaces, solitude, and that much abused term, peace of mind. The image is of the clean and peaceful outdoors, which harried city folk long for and imagine to be the perfect bliss. The professional herdsman who knows the tedium, the bite of the weather, and the sudden attack of the animal, the predator, probably has other dreams. But it doesn't matter. The question is not whether the bucolic is in fact bucolic, but whether the poem succeeds in evoking a mood of buoyant and strengthening faith. And I think it does. In purely literary terms, these verses pass muster. Even if we have never experienced a faith which refreshes the soul, as we read these lines, we know its reality, and that is the acid test of any bit of poetry. This poem is an idyll. Its striking appeal rests in every man's ever-present longing for the security and encouragement which it suggests. Over the ages, many have read into these lines perhaps more than they promise. You will find commentaries which would relate this psalm to a messianic redemption and to every possible manner of personal good fortune. Conversely, the young and the exuberant often dismiss this psalm as exaggerated, if not innocent. Careful reading of the text makes it clear that the poet is neither an enthusiast nor naive. Faith may brighten each day and lighten the load, but the purest of saints suffers infirmity and heartache. God's blessing is bountiful, but each day has its close, and each day has its ominous shadows. There are enemies about. The familiar English, "Thy rod and thy staff comfort me," unfortunately blurs a deliberate subtlety through which the poet has deepened his pastoral image. Rod and staff are synonyms in English which describe the shepherd's crook, that long, curved stick with which he guides and manages the flock. But that does not end the matter. In the Bible, rod is used as an allusion to the darker side of life, the rod of my anger. The psalmist suggests in a single line three separate ideas. One, the sheep settle down comfortably within sight of the shepherd's staff. They cannot speak, but the familiar croc informs the flock that this is their guardian and not a stranger. The human flock is calmed and quieted by the presence of God. We somehow feel more secure within sight of our temple, the visible presence of God in the midst of the people. When the world shudders about us, we retreat instinctively into the sanctuary. Recall the throngs who came the day that President Kennedy was assassinated. And finally, to the man of faith, the bitter in life is also a part of the divine wisdom. He has come to accept whatever each day holds. For thou dost not, O God, willfully afflict the sons of men. The poet does not expect to find heaven on earth. The miracle to which he thrills is that he can walk on the wild side, this side of heaven, without trepidation. Now, Judaism defines atheism as the affirmation there is neither judgment nor judge. Atheism accepts creation as a chemical accident and life as a biochemical fact which we must accept with as much grace as possible. The atheist can be and often is a fine human being, but his universe is cold, void, and unrelenting. The biblical faith which this psalm capsules denies the emptiness of space and the vanity of birth. Man is not alone. The Lord is my shepherd. God is the spiritual presence within the universe. Now, argue with this faith if you will. It is, after all, a matter of faith. But recognize the strengthening power and recognize it has brought coherence and moral conviction to human civilization. The psalm is cut of homespun cloth. Some find God in the majesty of infinite space. Some find God as they trace human progress. Some find God in the promptings of the still small voice within, the conscience. The poet seems to have found God almost without looking for him. It was not enough for him that there are hopes that do come true and joys that can be realized. He gives me rest in green pastures. He guides me by the restful waters. It is true that to live is to be bruised, but it is equally true that joy often comes with the morning. Those who paint life in black and gray distort its image. There is the gentle breeze as well as the hurricane. Now, Hebrew poetry has much in common with modern blank verse. As I said, it makes no pretense at rhyme. And though it reveals a certain rhythm and stress, there is no attempt to fit the language into a complicated metrical pattern. Hebrew poetry depends upon three canons. It was written to be sung, and melody imposed upon a language a certain cadence and role. The language used was carefully chosen, precise and symbolic. It conjures up known images, shepherd, pasture, still waters, staff, but uses...